Good afternoon, my conscious co-creators. Good morning, good evening, wherever you're tuning in from. Welcome to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. I am very, very pleased that you are all here with me today. We have another wonderful show in store for you with a fascinating gentleman who I'm looking forward to bringing on shortly. But first, of course, it is our blog post from a couple of years ago, just kind of taking these in order. And this is an interesting one. This is a topic I don't think I've talked about on my blog before. And the title of this blog post is "The Only Way Through the Pain of Rejection is to Be Present to It." Rejection is never easy. We have all felt rejected at one time in our lives. Over time, the pain of rejection lessens until the next one comes. The rejection we experience may be from friends, lovers, family, or even institutions. Some people learn how to have a thick skin and deal with rejection that way. Others feel crushed every time they are met with rejection. Most of us are somewhere in between. We learn to be okay with some forms of rejection over the years. Yet still, the sting of rejection from someone close to us may affect us greatly. That searing pain when we bare our hearts until to be met and until we're met with rejection is the most painful. It may not be from the love of our lives, yet it still hurts all the same. We might fall into a funk because of it, or feel the need to seek the help of a professional. Sometimes we drown our sorrows by diving deep into our livelihood, distracting ourselves from the pain we feel in our hearts. There are many ways we can distract ourselves. We can do it through our phones, our work, extra projects, or even going to the gym, filling up every waking hour with something so that we don't have to think about it. Yet we do. We think about it every second when we are not focused on our distraction. And it is okay to want to be distracted for a while, to allow some distance from the painful event until we are strong enough to truly face it. The real challenge is that whenever we do work up the courage to face it, it is still going to be as painful as it was before. It is still going to break our hearts. Maybe even take us out of commission for a while. It is not a matter of if, but when. So, in the end, no matter what we do to delay the inevitable, we eventually have to deal with the pain. All of it. Or it will fester inside our bodies until it kills us. And that does not serve us at all. The only way past the pain is through the pain. Numbing ourselves only pushes it down into the unconscious, where it will surface in other ways. So, for better or worse, we have to deal with the pain of rejection. Somehow, finding a way to feel that, even though this person rejected us, does not mean we are bad, unworthy, or defective. It just means they were not in a place to accept whatever it was that we were offering at that point in time. Perhaps the future will be different. And maybe, just maybe, the next time we take a chance, we won't be rejected. So I've had a lot of clients over the years who had a really hard time dealing with rejection, dealing with not being accepted for something. And most of the time, it's usually about a relationship. Not always, but usually. But, sometimes it's about a job. Sometimes it's about being rejected by a family member. Sometimes it's about a project getting rejected. I mean, if you're a creative, maybe you're an actor or a singer or a dancer, you have to audition, you deal with rejection all the time. But this particular piece I wrote after working with a client who had met this woman, and they really, really liked her. And they had been communicating virtually for a couple of years, I think. She had lived in another country and then moved here finally, and they met in person once and then twice. And this person felt such a strong connection to her. And then they finally had the courage to ask her out, to say, "Hey, would you like to, be my girlfriend?" And she was just not in a place for it, for whatever reason. I don't know. He didn't really say whether she had just broken up or just come out of a relationship, or just maybe she just wasn't into him in that way. But he felt crushed, and he was sharing with me the pain of the rejection and how he didn't really even understand it. Because they had gotten together so well, they were so in alignment on so many things, and they were really like there for each other in so many ways. And he felt this strong connection to her, but she did not feel that same kind of connection for him. And so in listening to his story and working with him to kind of get past that pain, I realized that it's actually a much more common pain than we realize. That rejection is something we deal with all the time. But most of us don't deal with it that consciously. We don't allow ourselves to feel the pain of it. I mean, like anything else, we don't allow ourselves to feel the pain of so many things. And our default is to distract, to numb ourselves. And many people numb themselves through alcohol, through smoking, through drugs, through the opposite, through exercise, through extreme sports, through whatever, addiction to pornography or sex or whatever. And I realized, like, it's all the same thing. It's all just a mechanism by which we don't have to feel the pain. And that so does not serve us. That so is actually the worst thing that we can possibly do. Because as uncomfortable as it is to feel the pain, if we don't allow ourselves to feel it, what happens? Well, we push it down. It still lives inside of us. It starts running unconsciously and starts causing us to make certain decisions and choices that don't necessarily serve us, and it's still there inside our body. And so, what can happen is it turns into some kind of physical issue, some kind of disease, something that can turn into something really serious. There's no escaping it. Our feelings. Yet so much of society, because we value the mental, we value the mind more than the heart, we escape up into our mind and we think, oh, if I just figure things out, if I just do things a certain way, if I just figure how to be and control things, like then I'll be safe and I'll be fine. Unfortunately, life doesn't work that way. Unfortunately, our bodies don't work that way. You know who's really good at dealing with rejection? Salespeople. Because salespeople have to deal with rejection on a daily basis for their work. And so salespeople learn to let the no's roll off their back. To let the rejection, and because they do it for work, they can deal with rejection in any other part of life. But for those of us who are not professional salespeople, for those of us who are not used to rejection, it can be one of the most difficult things to deal with. Especially when it's a rejection after you've just opened your heart to someone and they reject you. And that shuts down a piece of our soul in a way, because then next time we're going to be much more guarded when we open our heart to someone. And we may even be less likely to open our heart to anyone. And then life becomes a little more dull. More flat, more bland. Because when we don't feel the lows, when we don't feel the pain, then we can't feel the good stuff. We can't feel the love, the happiness, the joy. So, unfortunately, if we want to live life to the fullest and feel life to the fullest, we have to experience it all. Now, look, I'm not saying you have to do it all on your own. I'm not saying you got to live in your pain 24/7. You don't marinate in your pain. But if it's really that hard, find a professional, find a psychotherapist, a psychologist, a healer, find somebody who you trust, who you feel safe with, that you can work with to help hold space for you as you find your way through the pain. My wife and I do it for, our clients and for many people. But there are lots and lots and lots of people out there who can hold it. Find somebody who resonates with you and couldn't hold it for you. So that's my blog post for this week. It's entitled "The Only Way Through the Pain of Rejection is to Be Present to It." And of course, you can always find my blog on my personally branded website, theconsciousconsultant.com, as well as on the station's website at talkradio.nyc/blog. All right. Now, it is my extreme pleasure to welcome to the show author, meditator, and lifelong seeker Brian Muldoon. Brian's path has bridged law, spirituality, and deep human connection. From an early desire to live a monastic life to becoming a pioneering figure in conflict mediation, Brian has spent decades exploring how we can bring compassion, presence, and healing into the heart of everyday life. His journey has taken him from courtrooms to global interfaith gatherings, including organizing historic dialogues with the Dalai Lama, always guided by a deeper calling to unite the spiritual and the practical. Brian shares the story behind, will share his story today behind his new novel, The Luminous One, a work born from years of spiritual inquiry, interfaith dialogue, and personal transformation. Inspired by part in part by his travels in the Himalayas and his relationships with spiritual teachers, the book explores the emergence of a modern spiritual figure and asks timeless questions about what it means to embody compassion, wisdom, and divine presence in today's world. Welcome to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Brian.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. And your piece on rejection was really beautiful, spot on. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, that somehow they always seem rather apropos for the conversation of the week.
Well,
Just
you've got me thinking, that's for sure.
okay, good, good. That's the whole point. I'm just curious, how did you organize a gathering with the Dalai Lama? And he's not an easy person to get a hold of. He's is he?
He's not, but I had become a very close friend of a Catholic monk when I lived in Chicago, who named Wayne Teasdale, brilliant, wonderful guy. And Wayne had been ordained as a monk in both the Catholic and the Hindu traditions.
Oh, wow.
So he was a living integration, and had written a book after his PhD thesis at Fordham. He'd written a book called The Mystic Heart, which really explains what the spiritual foundations are of any number of major religions. Anyway, Wayne just happened to be walking in London, probably wearing his monastic robes, and somebody came up to him and said, "Are you headed for that meeting with the Dalai Lama?" And he goes, "No, I don't know anything about any such meeting." And this guy said, "Well, I think you'd like it. Why don't you come with me? That's where I'm headed." So Wayne showed up, unannounced, uninvited, and the only seat that was available at the meeting was the one immediately next to the Dalai Lama. So they had a two-way conversation. And when the Dalai Lama is talking with you personally, it always comes across as a very profound thing, and he loves to take people by the hand and hold them as if they're his best friend. Anyway, His Holiness held Wayne's hand the entire meeting, and Wayne became a substitute, really, for Thomas Merton, great Catholic mystic.
Yes, Thomas Merton was wonderful.
And Merton died sadly in, I think it was 1968. He was electrocuted accidentally at a meeting in, I think, Thailand. But anyway, after losing Merton, the Dalai Lama was really looking for someone who embodied the Christian ethic of humility, service to others, compassion, the strong helping the weak. And Wayne really embodied that. To get to know him, he would, seriously, he would walk out of a major meeting if he heard that there was a small bird that had tried to fledge and just plopped down on the sidewalk. As much as, so he didn't care if somebody thought they were important or not. Wayne really connected at the heart level. In any event, over the years, Wayne became very close to His Holiness and also to the Dalai Lama's younger brother, Tenzin Chogyal, or TC. And Wayne and I had become good friends also, and along with Barbara Fields, who was kind of the program director of the Parliament of the World Religions in 1999. The three of us kind of schemed up a plan to introduce the principles of compassion to a wider audience. So we connected with people who were in business, advertising, education, technology, science, spirituality. We had 40 participants in a week-long conversation with His Holiness. And had another 100 folks or so who were observers, but whose observation really helped enliven the conversation as well. So this was just a life-changing event for me. Kind of my job was to head the facilitation of conversations. So control the mic, bring out issues that need to be addressed. Try to spark a conversation among the participants, that kind of thing. And That, as I said, was life-changing,
Mm-hmm.
to be in not only in presence of the Dalai Lama, but in conversation with him as well. Just an extraordinary opportunity for everyone who participated, and
Wow.
also a challenge, because we always think, well, if I could just get to know so and so, that would change my life, you know. So everybody was very anxious to have their lifelong studies or activities acknowledged and appreciated by the Dalai Lama. So there was a fair amount of sort of scuffling with, I don't need to hear more than 2 minutes of your opinion about something. I have something I'd like to say. And so all of us found that our egos were very much opened up and exposed to all the world. And there was a documentary made about the event called Dalai Lama Renaissance, which I
Wow.
strongly encourage your listeners to get, just a kind of embarrassingly frank exploration of the ego obstacles to becoming more conscious in the world. So
Interesting. Interesting. Many of my listeners know, and I think we mentioned in our pre-show conversation that, monks hold a very special place in my heart because the founder of the radio station of talkradio.nyc became a Theravada monk. And that I bought the station from him in order to enable him to go. He was selling off all his worldly possessions, so he now spends his life meditating in the forests of Thailand and Malaysia.
Well, that's pretty profound, yes.
But you had in your bio, it said that you had a pretty young calling to this idea of a monastic life. W was there something that affected you when you were younger, that or was it just sort of a natural pull, or was it just exposure to something? Like, how did you happen to be curious or lean in that direction?
Well, it all comes back to really tasty bread. When I was about 5 years old, my family, which was very actively Roman Catholic, we'd gone on we lived on the East Coast at the time, and we went for a drive in the Smoky Mountains, and there was a Trappist monastery there. And we stopped to talk to the monks, who had all taken a vow of silence, by the way. So they were kind of short conversations. But anyway, we had stopped there, and I saw these guys who just seemed to be very happy, very comfortable in the world, these monks. And to support the monastery, they baked bread. So these monks sold their bread on the open market, and I had some of his best bread I'd ever had. That's what I kind of remember about the visit. But in the Catholic legends, there's this idea that if a mother basically donates one of her sons to the priesthood, she earns a complete pass on any kind of sinful behavior she might have ever committed in the course of her lifetime. So, so there was kind of unspoken pressure from my mom on me and my two brothers that maybe one of us would become a priest. And I thought that'd be great. It'd make my mom love me even more if I were to do this, you know. And I'm giving her an eternal payoff. When I was 13, I applied to be admitted to a seminary, and the recruitment priest came to my home, and he said, "Well, you seem like a nice enough young man, and maybe this is your calling, but you're also only 13. Don't you think you ought to get to know something about the world?" And I said, well, you're a missionary order. It was the Maryknoll Missioners. You're a missionary order, so I'll have plenty of opportunity to know the world. And he goes, no, not that world. Girls, you should really figure that out first. And so I said, I'll check into that. And that was the last that I pursued the seminary or the priesthood. Still exploring that question. But
wonderful.
Anyway, I, you know, as a young, like my sisters, I have five sisters, they all wanted to be nuns when they were of a certain age and dedicate themselves to the Virgin Mother and all this. So we were all heavily
gotcha.
Indoctrinated by the idea that the highest thing you could do in life was to pursue what they call a vocation. So I actually thought about that all the way through college. And shortly after that, broke the tie and got married and ended up going to law school, which is about as secular as can be.
As far as you can get, right?
Exactly.
So what kind of got you from sort of that very sort of Catholic mindset to focus more on spirituality and more on, you know, the interfaith and the broader view of God and spirit?
Well, certainly attending the Parliament, which was a big event in that occurred in Chicago, there were 6,000 people who attended, and we had a 50-person facilitation team, so that every day you would be in kind of organized conversation with other people, all of whom were sharing their own aspirations and practices and stuff. So that was a huge influence, because I was very involved in that activity and helping to set up an ongoing interfaith group after the Parliament. But I had actually begun meditating when I was in high school, back in the 60s. The Jesuit priests actually brought in a master of meditation to our high school.
Oh, wow.
And everyone was given the opportunity to learn how to do basically transcendental meditation.
Wow.
So that part of me, you know, it was quieted, but it was still quite active in my consciousness, because the idea of pursuing a spiritual path just had an appeal that just wouldn't go away. So when I had the opportunity to see people like Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama and leaders of every form of religion, see them all together and see the power of their practice, it really had a big impact on me. And the people who were there and who were very involved basically stayed in contact with over the years.
Yeah, so you had already been a long time meditator by the time you met all these people.
Yes, and Wayne taught me a variety of other meditation techniques too.
Wow.
You know, that became kind of a defining influence.
Got it. Wonderful, wonderful. We just got a minute or two before the break, so I want to start talking about the book after the break. But I'm just curious, with your travels and your studies, have you ever experienced what you would consider a mystical experience?
Oh yeah. One I remember in particular was years ago, someone who had kind of mastered a variety of processes, like from Est and Lifespring, and had been a consultant to my brother and his company. And he paid to have everybody in his employ go through a weekend training with a couple of these facilitators. And I was going through a divorce at the time. He encouraged me to come. I said, "This sounds silly to me. It's a bunch of woo-woo stuff." He goes, "Well, I'll pay for it. And if you find it useful, you pay me back." And I was profoundly affected by this as I learned that our choices in life define us, and we need to take responsibility for that. And we're not just victims. And it both opened me up to the profound sense of loss that I was experiencing in the divorce, and the sort of limitless possibilities for life going forward. So I was having both of those experiences, and went and learned how to be one of their trainers. Because I tend to jump in all the way when I find something I like. So I was in, and then thought, you know, this business of being a lawyer, is this really my true calling? And so I took a sabbatical and lived down in Puerto Rico for a year and a half, trying to figure out an answer to the question, what does it really take to bring people to an experience of fairness, mutual respect, and closure? And how does that interface with the legal system? And so I spent my time studying sacred literature and learning what true completion and closure was all about, and mapped out a process that was pretty universal for dealing with that. And I thought, well, the legal bar in Puerto Rico is not really ready for this, but they tell me if it's popular and successful in the States, maybe they'll do it. So I had to go back to the mainland and started one of the first mediation firms in the country with a couple of. So to me, it was a practice of legal healing. It wasn't enough to simply get an economic settlement. It needed to go all the way. So I then wrote a book called The Heart of Conflict about what the steps are for confronting and resolving conflict.
All right,
Taught that.
listen,
Say again.
let's take a quick break. We're going to take a quick
Gotcha.
break. And when we come back, let's start talking about your other book, The Lumin. How many books have you written, by the way?
This is just my second. Well, I wrote a couple of practice novels, but this is the second real one.
Second published book.
Yeah.
Okay. And so let's start talking about that, the Luminous one, when we come back from break. Okay.
Great. Sure.
All right. Everyone, please stay tuned. You're listening to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We do this every Wednesday, 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on talkradio.nyc and all over social media. And we'll be right back with our guest, Brian Muldoon, author of the new book, The Luminous One, in just a moment.
Are you a spiritual seeker? Are you interested in expanded states of reality? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant. And on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will dive into these topics with authors, teachers, researchers, and guides. Tune in at our new time, Wednesdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Wednesdays, 12 noon Eastern, on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Brian, you wrote this book, The Luminous One. What was the kind of kernel or seed of inspiration for this book?
Well, I would say irritation.
Okay. Irritation with what?
With conventional religious structures.
Okay.
You know, I think many times when people say they have a certain belief, that's not actually true. I mean, it's true that they think they do, but many times I think people purport to believe in something, but are not able to explain or defend it or justify it in any way. So you know, as I said, I grew up, you know, strongly Roman Catholic. I was an altar boy for years, and you know, I just kind of was in love with incense and Latin incantations. But I had come to a point in my life, you know, I had been sort of sending out little probes out to the universe to figure out what was the kind of true path, and what would it take to actually walk that path. And so I joined and unjoined a number of practices. I spent time doing Native American prayer circles. I went through Christian Science training. I, you know, if somebody had an opening to a practice that seemed like it held real possibility, I jumped in. So I had gone through a number of these, and I thought, none of these really is what I actually believe. They're filled with things that are not believable by anybody, and I'm not going to pretend that I do. But there's a powerful kernel in there, and that's what needs to be located and our inspiration. I happened to be on a trek with some friends through the Himalayas, guided by a Tibetan monk. As we had helped fund the construction of a school in kind of remote Zanskar, which is a place nobody's ever heard of. But it's the very tippy top northernmost part of India. And when you land there, it's easily 10,000 feet. And as we trekked along, we got to over 17,000 feet elevation.
Wow.
So, and Zanskar is incredibly beautiful. It's dry, high mountains. And so as we were trekking along, each of us kind of fell into our own cadence as we walked. And I remember just walking along this path and hearing the most beautiful song I'd ever heard from a songbird sitting on a rock alongside the road. And it just made me stop. And because I'd been thinking, well, should I really take up this monastic thing again? Should I really commit myself to that? And if I did, would I want to be a Catholic monk or a Buddhist monk, or what kind of monk would I be? And so all this is going through my head. And I stopped when I heard that bird singing. And I got this sense somehow that I was being called by somebody. And it was like, come find me. And I thought, there's just piles of rubble along the way here. And the feeling I had was, find Jesus in the rubble, because that rubble is the institution that was built around him. But you've got to dig deep to find him. And you've got to clear away the rubble to get there. And I thought, okay, I'm going to write about what I really believe. I'm going to write about a Jesus you can really believe in, not the legendary one. Because I'd done some study of biblical scholars and, you know, had the usual kind of awakenings that the Gospels were not written by anyone who knew him. They were all hearsay. And hearsay is not reliable, as any trial lawyer will tell you. and people's memory is, generally is terrible. So this is the Bible is like the last document you would ever want to rely on to establish what was true. And I thought it is really critical that it be true, not somebody's fantasy or secretly acting like you believe in Santa Claus, but of course you don't really. And I'm a believer in a good story. So so I took a look at the 18-year period known generally as the lost years of Jesus. In the Bible, in one of the Gospels, they have him as a 12-year-old boy, quite brilliant, kind of a prodigy, speaking to the elders in the Jerusalem temple about matters of theology. And then there's not a word about him until he appears at age 30 and supposedly is starting his ministry. So there's an 18-year gap there, the lost years. I thought that's where the story goes. And the story is, how do you become somebody like Jesus? Because wasn't that kind of the point? I mean, we see signs everywhere saying, I follow Jesus. Well, if you do, you're gonna have a very different experience, because that was a path that's not easy.
Right.
But it was a path that is well known by many traditions, a mystic path. Yeah. Because they have different words for it, but whether it's mastering your ego or developing compassion or loving everyone, even your enemies, there is a process of overcoming that which holds us down, our ego and our limitations in that way. And all these paths ask that of us, that we do whatever it is necessary to have that transcendental moment, that contact.
And so, did Jesus have no ego, or did he have an enlightened ego?
Well, I don't know, but I would have to say it's an enlightened one.
Okay.
Because like all human beings, he developed. Meaning he wasn't just some golden puff of divine air that somehow settled like a cloud on the world. No, he was a man. He was a human being. And as you probably know, there was the Council of Nicaea
in
345 or something like that. And that dealt with the question of whether he was begotten or made. That became a big issue. And did he have a divine nature as well as a human nature? Well, we hear a lot about the divine nature and almost nothing about the human nature.
Yep.
So the reality I think we can say is true is that he was a Jewish peasant who had some extraordinary experiences and was very charismatic and drew people in. But I don't see much evidence for his trying to start a new church or you know, any of that. He was trying to be a good Jew. That's why he was quizzed on those things. You know, what are the commands? So part of my ambition was to restore that humanity to him. Start digging through the rubble.
So what's the premise for the book?
That there is a path. And each of us is capable of finding it if we look hard enough. And the benefit of that is extreme. But we need to learn to live with contradiction and paradox and ambiguity as we're walking that path. And shy away from anything that would have us pronouncing that whatever way we've come across is the only way or the true way, or No, there are an infinite number of ways. And each of us, even if we think we're following somebody else's path, we're not. Even if we think that our spiritual life is being dictated as part of a formula, we're not. Each of us is, as my dad used to say, the captains of our own ship. We're all fully, the only one who has authority over us is ourselves. And everything else is just giving it away. So the premise is find that path, give yourself the freedom to explore and honor your own imagination. So at the beginning of the book, I say, this is a book of a work of fiction. This is not true, not in a literal sense. Hopefully it's true in an ethical sense, but let's start with the idea, the admission that it's just a story. But you know, we get a lot out of stories. In fact, the best
way we learn.
Yes, exactly. So this is a story. It's one that I made up. Make up your own. You know, or do something that in you know, you remember. What was it called? The Twilight Zone with Rod Serling.
Yes. Right? Love that old show.
A great program. And that little introduction that he gave at the beginning of the show, I can still see that black and white TV, and he's got his cigarette, and he's looking at you like he knows more than you ever will imagine. And he says, there's a place that's beyond the universe, that's bigger than anything we could imagine. And that's the realm of imagination. Yeah. And we have to fess up to how powerfully we use imagination in everything that we do. Let's do the same thing with our spiritual path. Let's not pretend that this is, you know, a given divine scripture. Let's play with it and see what we can learn from our own version.
So I'm curious, what was the most difficult part about writing this book? Since it is a work of fiction, you're basing it on a historical a figure whose certain period of time we don't know what happened. What was the biggest challenge for you in all that?
Well, My goal was to open up an avenue for people to appreciate him. Because I think that there's something kind of twisted in our depiction of Jesus.
Yeah.
That what we have not done is grieve him, grieve his loss. If he was anything like the stories about him, then he's somebody you would really love. But that kind of love I haven't seen much of, you know, within the... And it's because you were talking about how we resist any kind of rejection. Because if you're not really embracing it, it's going to do damage. And I would say grief is the same thing.
Yeah,
if 100%. If you have unexpressed grief... and who would you have more grief for if you had lived at that time and had met this powerful figure who invited you into his world? You would have been devastated by his loss. And you know, just kind of my personal view is that his story alone, and it's one of tragedy, should not be symbolized by a crucifix, a weapon of incredible pain and torture and humiliation.
I've heard
that's
people,
not to be celebrated.
Right. I've heard people criticize that the way it's depicted, it's almost like a death cult. We're celebrating a death of a human being, not his life.
Exactly. And you know, there's kind of an obvious reason for that. If we celebrated his life, then we'd probably have to try to imitate it.
Right,
You know, this lets us off the hook. It's like, oh no, he saved you. And they have this very convoluted idea of what goes into being saved. And by the way, what was it we were saved from?
Right.
You know, there, the envelope has not been opened on many of these questions yet. So, but my goal was to at least have people thinking about these things to make that more available.
A long time ago, I read this thin little book that was written by two Jewish scholars who took the ancient Greek texts and translated them back into the original Aramaic to look at the language and the idioms and to kind of understand really what, and then this little book was called What Jesus Really Meant. And it was trying to put things back into context.
Yeah.
And how things like his mother Mary being a virgin, the word that was used was the word for a young maiden, not a virgin, but they were often equated, but they weren't necessarily the same thing.
Right. And that is the case with a lot. I mean, I don't speak Aramaic, but, you know, I've read an Aramaic version of the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. You know, in a way that it never could be in Greek, which is what the Bible was written in. and so we have these scholarly revelations about what was said, what was done, what was the environment at the time. For example, the word Christian wasn't even used.
There was no such thing as a Christian back then. And from what I recall, they said, you know, he actually didn't preach to non-Jews. He purely taught to Jewish people of his time.
Right. Yep. And the Jew adjacent, like the woman from Samaria.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And so then the question I have is, why do we not completely embrace the truths of this? Why do we insist on saying things like she was a virgin, which makes no sense and doesn't do a single thing for you spiritually, as far as I can tell.
Right.
I mean, it gives you can create a statue and pray to the statue and, you know, have a rosary, but you don't need her to have this mysterious birth narrative in order to get to the meat of it.
Right. Right.
So I think there's a big challenge these days because the scholarship's been pretty darn good on a number of these.
I imagine, you know, writing a book on Jesus in this way, it could be kind of tricky. Like a lot of people could get very offended by it. I'm wondering, how has the reception of your book been? Have people... liked it? Have you gotten criticisms by it? Have you gotten, you know, death threats from people saying, how dare you?
Yeah. Well, that was actually the real answer to your question, which I avoided answering, I think, which is certainly and that's why I put a disclaimer at the beginning of the book. Hey, this is not the truth or trying to correct the prevailing narrative or anything else. This is a made-up exercise. But that does not stop people from having a reaction. Some have. For the most part, people have been, I think, felt a kind of sense of relief. It's like, there's a way I can actually retain my rational mind and be spiritually ambitious as well. I don't have to, you know, because generally a lot of religions charge a fee up front, and that fee is your beliefs. You have to, you know, sign over a belief in things that in your mind and in your heart could not possibly be true. In the existence of life since the time immemorial, human beings have never been able to produce other beings without male and female contributions to the process. So again, I would say, what's the point of having a belief that's patently false? But that, on the other hand, there are a lot of people who are not interested really in the truth because they have an alternative reality. And in my own family, a couple of my siblings did not greet it warmly, but happy to say have come around. I have a brother who's a deacon, and and this is not the conventional story. But fortunately, he's been very forgiving and open-minded about it, and I think sees that it makes sense at some level.
What did you learn about yourself through this whole process?
That all the things that I guess I would criticize others for, I am guilty of myself. Namely, if I really am offering this as kind of a guide or an exemplar, I should be living this life as well. I should be following. I should not, as the great ethicist Peter Singer said, every time I have a cup of coffee from Starbucks, I'm letting another child starve. You know, and the message of helping those who need help, you know, I'm a disappointment to myself in all the things I could be doing, but that I'm not, because of my own financial interests or insecurities or whatever. So it's a hard path to walk. I mean, it has its wonderful upsides, but it's not easy.
Well, Brian, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. It's wonderful to talk to someone who has a, I don't want to say practical, but grounded take on things that often are not approached in a grounded way when it comes to spirituality and religion. If people want to learn more about the book, learn more about you, is there a place they can go online?
Sure. Well, the book is downloadable from Amazon. So it's called The Luminous One, which is how he was originally called in China when Christianity first came to China in the 5th century. They actually blended Christian teachings with Taoism. And in the Taoist tradition, he was like the embodiment of the enlightened man. So they called him, and we still have evidence from that time. So that's where I stole the title. So it can be at Amazon and also at my website, brianmuldoonlaw.com, because I still do practice law. So
do you still?
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, Brian, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to come on the show. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed the conversation, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And of course, thank you, my loyal listeners, for tuning in each week. Without you, there is no show. And don't forget, if you did miss any part of today's show, you can always catch the replay on talkradio.nyc and on your favorite podcast application like Apple, Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio. We're in all of them. Thank you so much for tuning in. Take care. We will talk to you all next week.
Are you a spiritual seeker? Are you interested in expanded states of reality? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant. And on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will dive into these topics with authors, teachers, researchers, and guides. Tune in at our new time, Wednesdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Wednesdays, 12 noon Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.